It's the master.
It's the master's taking coins. It's the master's taking coins.
Day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 124 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And happy new year to you all. Depending on when this goes out, the 15th of this month is the podcast's sixth birthday. So happy birthday to us.
Oh, happy birthday to us. Chin chin, everybody. Chin chin.
And I've got a nice birthday cake here.
Oh,
with six candles in. So 1, 2, 3, and then blow them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
1, 2, 3. The relit. Have you used those trick ones that relight?
It might have just been my breath. Highly flammable.
Too much brandy on a podcasting evening.
So this is a chocolate sponge with a nicotine frosting. Well, it is now.
How was everyone's Christmas, chaps?
It went very well, thank you.
Lovely. Brilliant.
Did any of us get anything Doctor Who related?
Yes, I did. I got some Doctor Who Top Trumps, new series. Not new series, new Who ones. I think they're from the Tennant era, or possibly from the Matt Smith era, certainly no later than that. I got a variety. My sister just gave me a big box of Doctor Who stuff that she'd picked up secondhand at various things throughout the year.
Oh, wow. Of course, didn't you eventually get your Sontarans box set?
I did get my Sontarans box set with Harry Sullivan. Yes, I did. So I was very pleased with that. And I got several of the New Who annuals and the Brilliant Book, both copies of the Brilliant Book.
I think. Yes, yeah.
Although that all seems terribly old school now, doesn't it, already?
Just a tad. That's Matt Smith era, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What else did I get Doctor Who related? I don't know if it's slightly out of date now. I got a Hard Rock Gallifrey t-shirt. So I had it about 10 days and then found out the Gallifrey had been destroyed. So,
oh, what are the odds?
Yeah, exactly. Damn you, Chibnall.
Oh. Spoiler alert, anyone?
Yeah, so my lovely picture of Gallifrey's domed, or what would you call
it? Gallifrey's doomed, don't you mean, Mark?
Gallifrey's doomed, yeah. Anyway, it's the original lovely old Gallifrey before it got knackered again.
Oh, again.
Well, I got nothing Doctor Who related. I got the Blu-ray box set of The Prisoner, the original 60s one, which I've never ever seen before. So I shall have a go of that.
I'm happy to rewatch that with you if you ever want.
Oh, we've got to get back into Survivors.
That's
some
true.
Stage,
we've got 2.5 years of Survivors to get through yet.
Oh, good luck with that.
Guess I bought myself on Saturday.
Go on.
So that we can one day all do a synchronized Whoseum episode. I bought myself a Domain of the Daleks openable Dalek toy.
Oh, yes, the Bluebird. Yeah,
you know, with the TARDIS in and Davros as the roll-on deodorant.
Oh,
yes,
£12.
How much?
£12.
Oh, that's a bargain.
That is really good.
To be fair, it's unopened, but the sort of cardboard pack that's, you know, it's blistered onto looks pretty battered and scrapped. So I won't, I thought, well, if I get that, I won't feel at all guilty about actually just unpacking it. And
Well, that's true. I did go onto Twitter and do a poll as to whether or not, because I've had mine for a while now, and the other night I really felt like breaking open the packaging and having a play with it. And so I did put a little poll on Twitter, and naturally the monsters on Twitter wanted me to open it and not leave it in mint condition.
How evil they are.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to do that at some point. So yes, we can do a Hoosium unboxing.
Yeah, I believe I voted in that, Mark, and was one of those, one of the gaggle of your followers who invited you to
my followers.
I hope your third Galen is still inboxed.
Yes. My other Galen is I do still have one in stasis, as well as the one that I have larking around in my bedroom occasionally. Well, that sounds wrong, doesn't it? He's the one that I'm keeping in mint condition, I've got, but I've got the second one that I have around to play with, and obviously the first one I've only got the foot left of it. So,
what did you get for Christmas, Hayden?
Well, amongst a number of things, the only Doctor Who related present I received was from my sister, and it was this year's official annual, which now means that I have a complete set yet again of all the Doctor Who annuals from 1965 onwards. So it's quite nice, actually. I thought last year's one was didn't really have much to it. And this one is again, quite thin. I don't think they're ever going to release them to the size that they were in the 60s and 70s. But, I mean, this one's got, 60, 70 pages, I think? A few games in there and some short stories too, in the way that we used to have, which I think was lacking from the last one. The comic strip doesn't seem to... Actually, let's have a quick flip through. I don't think that comic strip's in there anymore. They used to have the Doctor Who Adventures comic strips, didn't they? There's no comic strip in this one. But they do have a double page spread called The Dardis Tater File. Oh, God. So let me just put my teeth back in. There we go. For every single story of Series 11, which means I've skipped 7 of them and only read about the ones that... I don't really care about the Battle of Avenue Q and... yeah, the other ones. I just can't remember the names off the top of my head right now. That's the only Doctor Who-related present I received. Although I did have... I don't know whether this comes down to... more being more stingy with my money, or whether it counts more for, the fact that I'm possibly a bit of a hoarder. But my wife bought me a dressing gown, and it's the first new dressing gown I've had since 2003. This lovely navy blue dressing gown, nice and soft and plush. It's lovely. But yeah, first time I've received a dressing gown is for 16 years, because I've up until Christmas Day, I've been wearing the same dressing gown for 16 years.
Was that your season 18 cosplay one?
Your burgundy number?
It was more of a... when I grew out of that one, because I had a growth spurt between 2000 and 2003. Actually, quite a few of them. I went from that to a sort of dogtooth coat, circa sort of Destiny of the Daleks kind of long dressing gown instead. But it had bitten the dust, but, you know... I'd had it for over half my lifetime, and it'd finally seen goodbye. So now I have a non-Tom Baker-related dressing gown for the first time in my life. How sad. That'll be on the cutting room floor.
I did notice that can't remember us watching anything on the television.
We didn't watch much. I was over at my missus' parents' place, and they had people come over on Christmas Day. And they watched a bit of Gavin and Stacey. But
we watched Gavin and Stacey, which is the first one of those I've ever seen. Okay. I thought, that was quite interesting.
I watched mainly the cricket over Christmas, and quite a lot of the football, and obviously Doctor Who on New Year's Day.
I saw the first episode of Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss's Dracula.
Oh, yes, I saw the first of those. I've not seen the second one yet.
No, neither have I.
I saw the third episode.
Have you?
I haven't seen the other two. I saw the third one because it was on in the background while I was painting one of my Airfix models.
Nerd.
And I have to say, oh, that's low. That's low coming from a
pot kettle. Yeah, actually, I have to say, I found the first episode genuinely horrific in places, very gory. And there was some nice throwbacks to previous Doctors. Previous Doctor Aculas. And I think there's one point where he looks really like Christopher Lee from one of the Christopher Lee Dracula films, when his eyes go all bloodshot and dark, and he's got all over his mouth, and he looks almost shot for shot like a scene from one of those Hammer ones.
I saw that Mark Gettys once again wrote himself a special scene to crowbar himself into the story.
That's pathetic, isn't it? I did read somewhere my
punchline was going to be the fat mother superior in episode one, but I didn't realise he actually did it because I've not seen two or three yet. Oh dear, that was a bit of a prophecy, wasn't it?
I was reading an article that was on the Poke website, and it was from an interview back in 2006.
You shouldn't tell us what sort of websites you go on, Hayden, like that.
It's fine, it's incognito, it's all good. And he was talking in 2006, this interviewer, about how he really wanted to bring back Adam Adamant Lives.
Oh, yeah.
And play the title role. But as this article said, he's no longer able to do that because nobody can find him because he's disappeared so far up his own arse.
No, the best thing on TV over Christmas, although I must admit I didn't see them live, I watched them later on BBC iPlayer, was Wurzel Gummidge.
I caught a bit of this.
Polly watched them though, and she said they were absolutely wonderful.
I have memories of John Pertwee's Wurzel Gummidge, but not particularly fascinating ones. I didn't watch it religiously at all, but this was just lovely, particularly the second one, where you've got Michael Palin as the Green Man, who it took me about 10 or 15 minutes before I twigged who he was. It just very, very gentle and beautiful. Have you seen them both, Hayden?
I saw the second one again. I just seem to keep getting
with the Scarecrow Bikers.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You must watch it, Mark. It will really cheer you up.
Yes, I do intend to.
It was the perfect tonic to a very turbulent world, I'd say.
And related to that, that was obviously he's played by Mackenzie Crook. So I then started watching The Detectorists, which he did with Toby Young.
Oh, yes, I've heard about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the first series of that? That's good.
When we were saying about a perfect tonic for quite a turbulent year, I bought, not long before Christmas, the complete collection of Carry On films.
Oh, yes.
And these are, obviously we all know what the Carry On films are. They're world famous. But they were something that I used to watch quite a lot as a kid with my sister. And I've got memories of watching, you know, like Carry On Cleo and Carry On Up the Khyber at my grandparents' for the first time. And I wanted that sort of, that comfort blanket again. Not, you know, and also just because I saw it was going on the cheap and it was, you know, a good collection of them. And I have to say, I mean, there were quite a few I hadn't seen before. I'd never seen Carry On Cabbie. I'd never seen Carry On Up the Jungle. And I'd never seen...
Oh, well, they're all taking the monkey around London.
That's it, yeah. I could take you, but not your brother. That kind of thing, yeah.
I mean, Spying is my favourite of all. The wonderfully done skit on the Third Man.
Hmm.
That sort of a Viennese, absolutely delightful. I've, for many years, been toying with doing a diddly-dumb sketch regarding Milchman.
Oh, yes.
Milchman! And Cleo is probably my second favourite.
Cleo and Khyber are actually very well plotted and very well written and very well realised as well.
I mean, Cleo's actually filmed on the original sets
at
Pinewood for the Burton and Taylor Cleopatra, which they eventually moved to Italy because they didn't want to do it in London.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And it tells as well, because you look at some of them and you think, God, they've really spent some money on this. And then you look, you delve deeper into behind the scenes and you realise, no, actually, they've just used an old set, which has just been vacated. I think The Romans was filmed on some of the sets of Carry On Cleo as well, wasn't it? I'm just going to check. The Doctor Who story.
They used some of the same props and stuff, didn't they? And costumes, I think.
I swear I've read somewhere. Sorry, I'm looking on TARDIS Wikia and I can't find any information about it. But I swear that when Ian's rowing, that's the same bit where you've got Kenneth Williams going, oh, you know, isn't it sickening? An emperor of Rome paddling his own canoe. It might be. Anyway, yeah. I want to get around to the point I was going to make. And that, yeah, I wanted to say that you can definitely tell where the humour becomes more crass and a little less clever.
Yes.
And it is around about that sort of camping point, I'd say. So about 69. And then after that, I mean, they come in three box sets. They've kind of got the really early ones are in one. The ones from the 60s and the early 70s are in the other. And then sort of what I'd like to call the dregs are on the third one. And I as soon as Carry On Camping comes along, I mean, that was such a big hit for them. After that, that's just sort of the direction they went in. Yeah, and I think the quality sort of tailed off, unfortunately. But the early ones, I mean, the black and white ones and the early coloured ones are fantastic. Carry On Cruising's a very, that's a very like Sunday afternoon film for me.
Hmm. So who gave you that?
No, I bought it myself. I saw it, you know, it was...
this is a very self-indulgent. We did have a bit of bad news between Christmas and New Year, though, didn't we, Mark?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's not very Doctor Who related. But, yeah, Neil Innes from The Ruttles, Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, and occasionally worked with Monty Python, which often seemed to be the thing that the news outlets seemed to lead with. Michael Palin was being interviewed about... the passing of Neil Innes and on Radio 4, and the interviewer said to him, so Neil Innes was known as the seventh Python. Michael Palin very quite rightly said, well, I don't think that's very helpful. He was the first Neil Innes.
Yes.
Yes, very sad. I was lucky enough to go with Polly to go and see the Ruttles, well at least two of the Ruttles, Ron Nasty, that's Neil Innes, and Barry Wom, the drummer, John Housey. Got to see them playing in a club in Lewes near Brighton.
Where they have the bonfires.
Yes.
The bonfire
nights. Yeah. And but that was back in May last year. And he was fabulous.
I'll tell the listeners about Polly being, of course, Mark's daughter. Tell the listeners about Polly's birthday.
Yes, Polly's a huge fan of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band and the Ruttles. And so just about a week before her birthday, I got it into my head that I'd try a shot in the dark, and I sent an email off to Neil Innes via his website saying, hi, my daughter's a huge fan, blah, blah, blah. It's her birthday come up. Is there any chance of a signed photograph? And I thought, well, if I get a signed photograph, that'll be terribly lucky. Anyway, on Polly's birthday, an envelope did arrive at my address, signed to Polly. Anyway, so I took it round to Polly and showed it up, and within there was not one, but four signed photographs. Two of them signed by Ron Nasty from the Ruttles, which was very nice, and a signed copy of his brand new CD that he just recorded, so, which is incredibly generous. There's absolutely no need to do that, and you don't expect it. You don't expect such a prompt reply. It was like within a week, I think, of me sending the email off. To say I would have thought myself incredibly lucky just to have got a single signed photograph, but to get four and a copy of his new album.
At the time, I wanted to mention it on the next podcast, but Mark's thank you to Neil was to say, no, actually, we'll keep it to ourselves, because probably the last thing he wants is to have a load of Doctor Who fans emailing him, saying, oh, can I have a signed photograph as well, please?
Yeah, I know. It is a worry, isn't it?
In fact, when the day or the day after... you got in touch to tell us that he died. I watched All You Need Is Cash for the first time.
Oh.
And I was watching it on YouTube on my computer screen, so I thought, I'll fast forward through this. But I watched it completely all the way through. I thought it was amazing the way they'd done it. It was
It's absolutely superb as a spoof rock documentary.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the best. It's the, I mean, the songs, the pastiche songs, the songs of the Beatles.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? That sort of thing.
It's more than just taking like a Beatles tune and writing new words over the top. It's so convincingly done. And the footage as well, the way it's filmed. It's a wonderful film.
There was a Doctor Who connection. You know when they do the bit where the Beatles go to India to see the Maharishi Yogi, whatever he's called.
Yes.
And they go to, I don't know, somewhere to Camden and see this really short guy on a station platform.
Yes.
That was Henry Wolfe.
Like Clapton or something,
played,
is it?
The Collector in the Sun Makers.
There is a slight connection between the Bonzo Dog Band and Doctor Who, in as much as one of their songs, which Neil Innes wrote, called Beautiful Zelda, on their second album, features the line "Beautiful Zelda from Galaxy 4," and it's all about an attractive alien woman who basically comes to Earth and tires Neil Innes out.
Ooh.
So yeah, I do wonder if he'd recently been watching Doctor Who and remembered the Galaxy 4 story.
How polite of him to dedicate it to Doc's favourite story as well.
You are, yes, right.
All the super hearts of the superheroes of the galaxy. So why does she wanna mess around with me? Yeah. Listen to my story, it's sad but it's true. Please don't laugh, it could happen to you. Space warp brought her to me. Oh yeah, the most beautiful girl I ever did see. Oh yeah, she gave me her hand, but when I held her, oh yeah, I was fooled by the beautiful Zelda. Beautiful Zelda, tell me the truth. I'm just a clean living on.
But yeah, that was terribly sad news, especially for me and Polly. We spend a lot of time driving around the Kent countryside, driving to various places, looking at castles and visiting towns and going through charity shops, looking for old records. And a lot of that time is spent with the Bonzo Dog Band as our background music whilst we're driving around. Yeah, it has been for some time, and it really felt like we'd lost a friend, really.
Mm. I've got to ask, have either of you ever heard his, I say performance, but have either of you ever heard him on Chain Reaction on Radio 4?
I don't think so.
No. Well, he answers it. He has a very unique interviewing style. So Chain Reaction on Radio 4 is when a celebrity interviews a celebrity, and then the following week, the celebrity who was interviewed does the interview themselves, and then it's...
Right.
Hence chain reaction. Neil Innes interviews Graham Linehan, the writer of Father Ted and the IT Crowd and Black Books, but he takes just generic starts to questions, and those are his questions. So he asks him, like, who are you and why are you here? where were you when you heard the news? And do you think it changed you when? And that was like that kind of thing. And it makes for a hilarious half an hour. I'll have to see if I can find it and dig it out, because it's great. And I'm sure
it's on the BBC Sounds app.
Yes, it will be.
Yeah, which I'm constantly getting reminders about all day when I have the radio on in the background. It seems to
got be... Got it. Okay. Computer. Can you look for Neil Innes Talks to Graham Linehan on BBC Sounds, please? There it is. Brilliant. Okay, I've got the link, so I'll send that on to you.
Okay.
And that link can be found over on our podcast blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, where you'll also find anally extensive show notes on the various things we discuss in this podcast. We also lost Donald Tosh, didn't we? Script editor from the Hartnell era, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I met him briefly at Time 5 back in 2010. Yeah, very briefly. He was on stage with Andrew Cartmell being interviewed by, I think it was Simon Guerrier, talking about the showrunners, or sorry, script editors at the time.
On New Year's Day and on the following Sunday, we had Spyfall, parts 1 and 2, the beginning of series 12. Now, Hayden.
Crumbles. Yes, sorry, I was getting carried away then.
Anyone want to start us off?
Go on, Mark, mate.
Well, I have to say, I thought on the whole, the two stories, certainly on the first viewing, I enjoyed them probably more than I've enjoyed anything from the previous season, excepting perhaps Witchfinders. Do you know what? These reminded me a little bit of the start to Series 6, the two-parter, Impossible Astronaut Day of the Moon.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because they felt more Moffat-y in some ways, with the seemed to be more use of time travelling and going through different ages, and because they were kind of bigger, bolder and brassier and much more confident than anything they'd done in the previous season. Big ideas and quite epic in feel in places. Like I say, which reminds me very much of that Matt Smith two-parter. But Polly hadn't seen it. In fact, she hadn't seen it though when I saw her earlier on today. And she's just watched it less than an hour ago and she's just messaged me. And I have to say, I'd probably go along with her. Would you like to hear Polly's review of it quickly, or should I save that?
Go for it.
I watched the first New Year's episode. I quite enjoyed it. Interesting story, but the dialogue's really rubbish, which I think lets it down. The Master was fantastic, though. And then she mentions the dialogue, and she says there were a lot of moments that she had her head in her hands.
Good old Polly.
Good old Yellow Pages.
So I have to say, I do agree, because even, I think, from very early on, I still think, what did we say most of the time last season about Chibnall's writing? It was that he can't write dialogue, can he?
Yeah.
It's dialogue. It's like he just hews it wildly out of randomly selected words. It's so clunky. I mean, I feel bad coming in straight away with a criticism, but...
Not as bad as Chris Chibnall currently feels.
Oh, well, he won't mind, will he? He's getting paid and he's... The worst thing was, when I re-watched these episodes, I watch it with the subtitles on to make sure that I'm picking that up, the dialogue correctly. And I have to say, reading it is even worse than hearing it. When you actually see it typed out on the screen in front of you, man, it's painful, isn't it? Anyway, shall I go on to some other more positive stuff and see if anyone else wants to mention about the dialogue?
You carry on, because what I want to say about the dialogue sort of is inextricably linked with the point I'm making about other things about the story.
Okay.
So you carry on.
I mean, there was lots of stuff that I enjoyed about it. Like I said, I thought it was the most confident production that they've done since Chibnall's taken over. The Doctor's mannerisms that we disliked last season, I think, have been dialed down. She's not quite so out of breath all the time. And I thought, especially in Spyfall Part 1, I really enjoyed some of the direction of it. It was very tense in places. I thought the big moments in the stories were done well. Rewatching Spyfall Part 1, I do sometimes find rewatching episodes a bit tiresome. But there was the added treat, because this time we could watch Sacha Dhawan's performance and look for all the subtleties in it. And there's a lovely bit, that first scene where you see him sat out in that chair and the TARDIS appears and he smiles. And it's actually a very dark, very knowing smile. And it's something that you don't pick up on the first time round. And I really enjoyed watching the character of O in that first episode with the added knowledge that he was actually the Master. And I thought the reveal of the Master was really good as well.
Well, I was watching it in the Hoosium Library for the reveal of the Master, and I was watching with a pile of the Hoosium Library service robots.
Mm.
And, you should have heard the reaction when they saw the reveal.
It's the Master!
It's the Master's taking time! It's the Master's taking time!
Had any of us been spoiled about that?
No.
I didn't have the first idea.
That was one of the most wonderful things about it, I think, was the fact that I wasn't expecting it. I didn't think that I didn't think that the character of O was a goodie, to be honest. I thought there was something fishy about him.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he was suspiciously well written, wasn't he? So.
Yeah. Yes, Sasha did very well with those lines, didn't he? It was the fact that I think because the last thing that Stephen Fry's C had said was rule one, don't trust anyone.
Yes.
And then as he got shot, he said, oh.
Yeah.
And then they went to O, and his house was suspiciously well rigged up with technology.
Yes, that's true.
And to be honest, I didn't think he was necessarily the Master, but I was wondering who he was in league with that was an alien. And then there was the bit when he sets the alarm, not the alarm off, he puts the defences up around the house when the Kasavin are closing in, and it's all...
It's like little hexagons, isn't it?
Yes.
Like the walls of the inside of the Doctor's TARDIS.
Yes, it was all little hexagons again, which made me sort of go, oh.
I didn't notice any of that. I was trying to remember back to Utopia. And I can't remember, had it already been revealed that he's going to be the Master? I think I did somehow. It wasn't, you know, this thing you still had at that time, this meme that used to go around the internet, where everyone says, oh, look at me filming my family and their genuine shocked reaction to Derek Jacobi turning into the Master.
Oh, yes.
And you didn't really believe a word of it. It was mostly bad acting. But I think vaguely we knew that was almost better done than this, but it was certainly came completely out of the blue to me.
Mm. Especially considering there'd been quite a well-attended preview screening, hadn't there? With a lot of the people that I follow on Twitter having been to it as well.
You media whore.
And so I was very appreciative that they didn't spoil it. Although I was a bit disappointed when immediately after the episode had aired, people were immediately online saying, oh my God, I can't believe the Master's back. And it's like, you know, there's a lot of people watching that on catch-up and stuff. I mean, you could just leave it a little bit. You don't have to say exactly... You can go online and say, oh my God, I can't believe they're ending that Doctor Who story. And have another people go and join in your excitement and go, I know, wasn't that amazing? You don't have to start going on about, I can't believe that Sacha Dhawan was the Master. Like, immediately, just seemed really...
You could post something like, oh my God, I thought that was...
incredible,
amazing,
yeah.
And what a twist at the end. But to actually just tweet something that says, oh my God, the Master's back.
Yes.
Well, we know. If you're not going to be spoiled by that, well, yes, we already know.
Yeah.
if you are going to be spoiled by that, don't post it.
Mm.
I don't think we can entirely say to people, oh, you know, there has to be a point at which we say to people who are delaying their viewing of the episode, well, just stay off social media for a while.
Yeah, people have got to talk about it at some point, but I just think, like, within seconds of the episode finishing, it was a bit harsh. I mean, some of these people have, like, thousands of followers as well who are doing it.
Was it Doctor Who Online in 2013, Hayden, that celebrated Night of the Doctor with the headline, Watch Paul McGann's Surprise Return?
Yeah, and their defence to that was that if it's already out in the public domain, then it's kind of more fool you if you come against it, which actually is the wrong way to look at it, I think.
I always imagine you and Mark, when you get angry about these spoilers, as the likely lads trying to avoid the England match result so they can watch it on TV in the evening.
And then getting home in the evening to realise the Doctor Who's been cancelled. Yeah.
Don't move your head.
Pardon?
Don't turn your head. There's a television dealer on your left, but it doesn't set so.
Oh, it's all right. Say the magic roundabout.
That won't stop them. We interrupt this programme for an important announcement and pillocks to poor old Zebedee.
Well, where shall I drive to?
Just keep going.
I don't really fancy driving out into the country.
No hiding place. You realise you're going down a one-way street?
So what?
So we can't turn round.
So why should I want to turn round?
Because in 50 yards we pass that one-legged news vendor flaunting his placard.
God, aye. Still, it won't give the score. It'll just say match result or England score latest.
What if it doesn't for once? What if it says England victory or England flop or Ramsey men shaken by Bulgars?
I mean, I have to say, I'm not as negative as the pair of you. I was coming into this feeling...
Well, we don't know what Doc thinks yet, do we?
Oh, I can sense it a mile off from what he was, from his reaction to your review. I wasn't looking forward to this, I must say, because I felt last series was a struggle to review because it was one of those where I think after three or four episodes I stopped watching it a second time before we recorded.
Yeah, there's no way I was watching Battle of Ranskor a second time.
And I think we have to admit, we started watching the rest of the series, each new episode, almost expecting to be disappointed, didn't we?
Yeah. Mm.
And I think in a way, if you do that, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
But and it did feel a bit like, you know, Series 11 was essentially a showrunner taking a crash course in writing science fiction for television all the way through it. And then I remember us saying that when we reviewed Resolution last year, that kind of had to be the blueprint for this form of the show going forward. And I think he's absolutely built upon the promise that was shown in Resolution.
I don't know, I was quite rough on Resolution, I think. I think I was so tired by that point that I ended up giving it 5 out of 10.
I can't remember what you gave now, but I think on the whole, we were fairly positive and thought, if it's more like this, then that bodes well. And I thoroughly enjoyed this. I thought it was really good, Doctor Who, and I thought, funnily enough, the elements of it which I liked, the sort of tapping into Doctor Who lore, you know, the coming back of an enemy, of a well-known enemy, that kind of thing which I thought may have needed a rest... for Series 11, and then there was actually to the detriment of Series 11, was back in this, and I think it gave it a bit of a shot in the arm. I liked the characterisations a little more. I still feel as though there's room for improvement, as it were.
Yeah, I did feel like Yaz suddenly became a more tangible character in these two episodes, particularly.
But it's still a mistake, though, isn't it, to have three companions, I think.
Oh, I think it definitely is. Particularly when you're going to then bring in Ada Lovelace, Noor Inayat Khan, and the Master. All right, the Master's a villain, but he's actually part of the family in inverted commas, isn't he?
He was, and he was airbrushed out in the trailers as well. Did anybody notice that?
I've heard about that. I quite like they've done that. They went to the effort of doing it.
Yes, so did I.
By the way, Mark, you were in a bad mood about Resolution because you actually gave it a lower score than I did. Hayden and Alan each gave it an 8. I gave it a 6.5 and you gave it a 5.
Yeah, I was really grumpy about it, I think, at that point.
While we were waiting to start this podcast, someone has written an article in The Guardian saying how offensive Spyfall was, in that the Doctor not only used the Master's ethnicity against him with the Nazis, but that he constantly kills off black and gay characters. And I think I replied something like, constantly, I can think of one, in a very sarcastic way. I've just looked at our notes for podcast 107, where we're reviewing Resolution. And our second bullet point is, has Chibnall got it in for gays?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that now.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I watched the second part a little delayed, because I've been out. But watching it on iPlayer on my laptop, whilst the missus had that Masked Singer thing on the TV.
Oh my god.
I only glanced up a couple of times to witness a dancing sunflower. But apart from that, the rest of the time, my eyes were glued to the laptop screen. No, I really, really enjoyed it. Just a couple of criticisms. I think even though Yaz was... Well, she had more to do. I just feel as though it's been a tiny bit of a stretch having three. It's one of those situations, a bit like what we've said in the past about the Fifth Doctor's TARDIS when he's got Adric, Nyssa and Tegan there. You know, if you were to have two of them there at any given point, or even one, it would be a very strong TARDIS lineup. I think Graham holds his own as a character, and I like the bits in the first part.
He always says that, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, I like the bits in the first part where he's in, unbeknownst to him at that point, the Master's TARDIS with the Doctor, having his own sort of mini adventure with her. Yeah. And then obviously Ryan and Yaz. I think they really do. They have to go, if they're going to do this for the past this series, and I hope for the rest of the series, of course, as well, split them up as often as you can, I think.
Yeah.
Because it gives them more room to breathe. When they're all back together again, it doesn't quite work for me, because there's just too many people to write for, and you don't have a lot of time with Doctor Who. It's so fast, you know, you have to get from A to B in a non-linear, non-subjective, timey-wimey way. You know, you've got so much to do in a Doctor Who script. Sometimes it's better if there's less people that you're writing for. I mean, I have to say, you both said criticism about the dialogue. I had the subtitles on as well, because my hearing's not too brilliant. I didn't notice that too much, to be honest. I think it's a simpler way of writing than we had, especially under Stephen Moffat. It was a much simpler way of writing. But, you know, I didn't mind it too much, that aspect of it. I thought Lenny Henry was all right as Daniel Barton. I thought Stephen Fry was slightly more underused than I thought he would be in the first part. And, yeah, I liked Ada and Nur, I think, were useful additions to the story and linked that narrative into it, you know, the fact that they were spies and, you know, the computer inventor, you know, I thought that was quite nice and harks back to previous series with plucking people out of history and having sort of celebrity guests, even though these two weren't very well known. It was good to have them there and learn something new, actually, I thought, from them as well. I'd heard of Charles Babbage, but I hadn't heard of Ada Lovelace, so... I thought the Kasavin were very effective villains, but going on to villains, I really, really enjoyed Sacha Dhawan's performance as the Master. But as a Doctor Who fan, it's bugging me slightly it's bugging me immensely that I can't seem to place him in the Master / Missy's timeline.
Well, can I interject here with regards to that? Because I've been thinking about that. And apart from multiple Doctor stories and multiple Master stories, Time Lords generally seem to be kind of time-locked into their lives carrying on parallel with each other, independent of whatever time, year they're visiting, whatever planet or, you know, wherever they are. And it always used to be the same with Gallifrey as well. Gallifrey was like the centre of the Time Lord universe. And the older Gallifrey got, that's the older the Time Lords got. And it's not like you generally get the Fifth Doctor suddenly encountering the Roger Delgado Master.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like David Tennant would suddenly be up against Anthony Ainley's Master.
Yeah.
So they've always seemed sort of time-locked to go in step. And so I, like I say, apart from obviously when it's sort of set-piece stories like World Nothing Time, Doctor Falls, or things like Five Doctors.
I suppose it helped that both Delgado and Ainley were dead by the time that could have happened anyway. So, well,
yes, but and that's the way things seem to have gone. So I still think this is post-Missy.
Oh, I do. I thought to myself, when I saw the reveal at the end of part one, I did think to myself, that's a bit early to bring him in, given that the whole climax of Peter Capaldi's era was, one, the idea that the Master had gone for good. And I don't think any of us seriously believe that.
Yeah.
But at least you might think, well, give it a few years, you know. But also, there goes the whole idea of Missy getting redemption.
Yeah.
At the end of it. But it's the sort of thing where I seriously think he was the best thing in Spyfall, Sacha Dhawan.
Yeah.
And I think...
I'd agree.
If we get that, and what we have to pay in return is, well, maybe it doesn't slightly fit into what we thought was happening with the Master, I'm quite happy to make that exchange.
The Master has died, definitely, for the very last time. Sometimes before, hasn't he? Let's be honest. Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, even in Deadly Assassin, it was at the end of his regeneration cycle, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So there's potentially umpteen... That's the sort of thing that I don't really care, I don't really mind about. As long as he's portrayed well, and they don't suddenly make him a goody-goody, I don't particularly mind whether they mess with his regenerations or not.
No, and also, we don't know what this timeless child thing is yet either, do we? Which is a large part of this Master's motivation.
For me, I liked how Missy's story ended so much in The Doctor Falls that I actually hope this is a Master past that, because it does sort of null and void that.
What, you mean post-Missy?
Yeah, I hope that he's pre-Missy.
Oh, right, yes, I see.
Yeah, because I just feel like her redemption story was so strong. And I really enjoyed that sort of resolution to her character, and that, you know, the fact that the Master kills himself essentially because he can't bear to be you know, standing alongside the Doctor.
Yeah, but as far as we know, that's still what she thought. So it's still that Missy and her motivations and what she thought she was doing at that time and her redemption still stand for that iteration, for that character. I mean, she thought she was sacrificing herself. And so I think her redemption still stands, but when Time Lords do regenerate, or whatever's happened here, you know, they do change a bit.
That is true. That is true.
And obviously, the discovery of the Timeless Child has done something to this Master.
That's, well, yeah, I suppose so.
I still think all the stuff you like about Missy, and I would agree with you totally on it. Yeah, that last season, and especially that last two-part of the Capaldi era.
Yeah. Yeah.
I still think that stands. Like I said, we don't know what's happened to this first of the Master. If it is post-Missy, we don't know how the Master's come back. We don't know what's going on with this Timeless Child thing.
Do you think we will ever know? Do you think that will ever be disclosed to us? Or do you think it will just be ignored, essentially?
Yeah, it definitely will be now. I mean, maybe it's not going to get mentioned again this season, like it only got mentioned once last series.
Yes, that's, yeah.
Does anyone have any theories about the Timeless Child?
No, I've seen a lot on the line, but a lot of them seem to be. How on earth did you come up with that? I'm beginning to wonder whether this podcast is spoiling Doctor Who for me. I mean, in a way, it's fair return because it spoils it for everyone else, but I watched Spyfall Part 1 on New Year's Day, and I found it quite fun. Little things irritated me, but I thought, oh, that's quite fun. But then I watched it again a couple of days later, with subtitles, so I can get, you know, a better idea for doing this podcast.
Yeah.
And I started to notice too many things that were just irritating me. Because I think my problem is I don't think we have a Doctor and TARDIS crew strong enough and charismatic enough to drive the story forward so that I can be swept along and not really care that much about the flaws in the story. Look, throughout Series 11, we called for an improvement, and I think Spyfall definitely represents an improvement.
Yeah.
So we should be careful of being churlish.
Mm.
But you could also argue that given what we saw in Series 11, almost anything would be an improvement. I think it's less of a case of it being better than one of it being less bad. I think the improvement here has been in the type of story. This sort of sub-007 romp across the world is always going to be more fun than exploring Sheffield. And I think moving to this kind of story, this structure of story, i.e. a sort of a across-the-world spy drama, almost inevitably brings about an increased change in pace. But the underlying problems for me are all still there. And once I know I start noticing them, I can't get rid of them.
Don't you think it's more with the Chibnall scripted?
Oh, definitely.
Directly
yeah.
scripted episodes than others.
See, Doctor Who's always, for its entire run, has always managed to get around budgetary problems by the three staples of good writing, good acting, and good characterisation. And in the past, where one of those was weak in a story, it was covered by the other two. The problem for me is that in Chris Chibnall's Doctor Who, all three of those, writing, acting, and characterisation, are serious weaknesses for me. I still can't work out whether his dialogue is being undermined by poor delivery choices by the actors, or whether his dialogue is undermining the actors. Something I was going to say about, we're not going to review Star Wars because Mark's not seen it, but one of the things I was thinking of Star Wars is, it's plot line after plot line after plot line delivered with a total lack of confidence, with most of the characters delivering the lines. And over Christmas, I rewatched Star Wars, A New Hope, the original film.
Mm.
And the famous line is, isn't it, George, you can write this stuff, but you can't say it.
Yes.
But actually, I don't have any problem with that. I was watching it and I was thinking, all right, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, and possibly to a lesser extent, Harrison Ford, none of them are the world's greatest actors. But they're delivering the lines with confidence, and the whole sort of narrative drive of the film is driving them on. And I believed all of it. When Alec Guinness says something like, you will never see a more wretched hive of scum and villainy, or, the force binds the universe together, it's quite possible that he doesn't have the first idea what he's saying. But you believe every word of it, because he's delivering it with confidence. I don't think that's happening here. Graham actually confuses me, because the fact that he does seem to be able to make something out of his lines suggests that it may be a combination of both. It's the fault of the actors and the fault of Chris Chibnall. He's managing to do something. So I can't imagine that Chris Chibnall is writing brilliant lines just for Graham. But I also can't imagine that Bradley Walsh is a much, much better actor than Jodie. So this is what's confusing me. Chris Chibnall wrote 7 out of the 11 episodes in Series 11. And I really hope he writes fewer of this series. Not as a sort of dig against him, but to give the cast a chance to show what they can do with another writer's dialogue. I think the root of the problem for me lies in his writing, though, which at times, it's almost comically inept.
Mm.
I don't think it's that he writes in a simpler style. You only have to look at a few examples, and you know when Ryan's asking to explain about the fish picture?
Yes.
There's another image hidden within the pixels of that photo. It's basic spycraft in your time.
So one's hidden inside the other?
Duck. Exactly.
Yaz gets introduced to Lenny Henry in the foyer of his offices, and his flunky says,
"Hi. I'm sure you recognise Mr. Barton."
"Certainly do.
This is Sophia Afzal."
"Hi, I'm Sophia."
The two Australian Secret Service agents who actually, you have on no less authority than Mr. Robert Irwin, have actually got convincing Australian accents. Although he's furious that they're referred to as Australian Secret Service agents and not Australian Secret Intelligence Service agents. Which makes you suspect that Rob might have some sort of...
Oh, he might be undercover.
Do you think so?
Maybe.
Maybe his whole... Because Dave Kitchen, the podcast with him, he's quite a politico, isn't he? Mm. You think Dave is like...
Oh.
When in Bond...
Hang on a minute.
where Bond walks into M's office at the beginning of the film. He says to Emma, "Hello, sir. Hello, Q." And you'll say, like, "Hello, Freddy," to the Minister of Defence.
Hello,
there.
Minister.
Yeah. Oh, right.
007. At last.
Good morning, sir.
I think you know Frederick Grey, Minister of Defence.
Commander.
Minister. Q.
007.
Anyway, they're outside the shack in the pitch dark, with the only illumination for miles being these lights which are going on and off, on and off. What does one agent say to the other?
See those lights going on and off.
What? If anything, they'd say, "What's with the lights?" And you almost suspect that, does Chibnall actually not read back over his finished script? And if he does, how could he fail to pick something like that up?
Yeah.
Unless, with Ryan, those two examples of Ryan and Yaz I've just given, the sole purpose of the second line is there for no other reason to give Ryan and Yaz something to say.
That goes back to what I said about there being too many characters in the melting pot.
Chibnall's having to justify their existence. As Mark said earlier, the exposition remains clunky beyond belief, but it doesn't have to be in the right hands. Even Stephen Fry, with his innate hamminess, when he's just said to, he's done that joke with Graham about, oh, he used to be a man, oh no, he's not. And they're walking through the corridors of MI6, and he's explaining,
"Over the past week, there's been a spate of attacks on intelligence officers worldwide of every nationality. None of these attacks has been ordered by rival intelligence agencies."
"At least that's what you're all telling each other."
"No, we all have a very good working knowledge of what our enemies are up to. No agency possesses the technology to carry out one of these attacks. None of us understands how it was done, or even what has been done. But every agent suffered the same fate."
It works really well.
Mm.
And he almost acts the three of them off the screen. So exposition can work to drive the pace along in the hands of someone with ability. I contrasted this not too long ago with Tom in Brain of Morbius, where he's doing the thing where he's about to fix the sacred flame with a firework. Oh, sorry, spoilers. He's got the line, "And the heat from the flame causes oxidation of the chemicals in the rocks and then a chemical reaction with rising superheated gases and you have your elixir, the impossible dew of a thousand alchemists drifting like sea for an urn." Now, the Thousand Alchemists line is a line for the ages, but the rest of it is the God, in the wrong hands, that could be really badly delivered, but Tom actually manages to make that all that exposition just sound conversational.
Mm.
And I think that's the problem here. So an actor on top form can bring life to the worst of lines.
"Is it always this colour?"
"Always."
"Fascinating. And the heat from the flames causes oxidation of the chemicals in the rocks. And then no doubt a chemical reaction with rising superheated gases as you have your elixir. The impossible dream of a thousand alchemists dripping like tea from an urn."
I just can say they do try that. You say about Graham's acting, there is that bit where they're outside O's shed and he says, "So, MI6, can I ask you something?" And O looks at him, you're thinking, what's Graham going to ask him? What's this interesting thing? And Graham just says, "Is it true that a tech company can be as powerful as a nation?"
Hmm.
And it's really clunky. And then O, even though he's been played by a great actor, suddenly goes into this bit of explaining how tech companies are so powerful, which also seems obvious anyway.
Yes. Mm.
And like I say, just incredibly, just clumsily done.
I think that's it, that's clumsiness.
"All right, MI6, help me with something because I can't get me nut round it. C told us that Barnes' company is more powerful than most countries. That can't be true."
"Governments these days are full of people who don't understand technology. So countries rely on outsourcing their tech requirements and expertise to private companies that transcend national boundaries. Companies like Vore."
The characterisation, the second thing, is something that remains weak. I don't think either Jodie or... You know my history. And for those of you who might be new to the podcast, I said for a while, oh no, don't make the Doctor a woman. That'll just be, jumping the shark. And when there was the reveal, was it after Wimbledon?
Yes.
Of Jodie.
Yeah, it was.
I briefly groaned and thought, oh my God, they've gone and done it. And then within about 24 hours, I was fine with it. I'd come to the conclusion, well, what am I going to do? Just sit there for the next few years with folded arms, pouting, saying, I really want this to fail just to show it. Or do I hope that it's actually, I'm proved wrong and it turns out to be really good? So I've got no problem with thinking of her as the Doctor. But then I didn't have any problem with Colin and Sylvester as the Doctor, thinking of them as the Doctor. It's just I wasn't particularly impressed by the way they did the Doctor. But I don't think either Jodie or Chris Chibnall know what sort of Doctor she's supposed to be. Although, I think there might be a change coming on that. Now, I think someone like Tom Baker had the confidence to decide that for himself. I don't think Philip Hinchcliffe said to him, right, I want you to be a sort of...
a bohemian.
That was all Tom's choice. Yeah. They would have probably discussed the costume between each other. But so I don't think Jodie knows what sort of Doctor she's supposed to be. Yaz and Ryan, the hard truth is that they're entirely superfluous.
Mm.
You don't have to artificially crowbar things in for Graham to do and say, because Bradley Walsh makes him a believable character.
Yeah.
The few lines he gets, he delivers so well that even if he's, for the rest of the episode, he's just standing around or running around helping the Doctor, he doesn't feel like an unnecessary character.
Hmm.
But it's bad enough when you've got too many characters and that two of them aren't being serviced properly. Excuse the expression.
I'm not being serviced!
But even worse when the portrayal of the Doctor lacks charisma and gravitas. I mean, I read recently someone saying that the Doctor seems like a bit player in her own story at times. But you think, this is what Chris Chibnall should be helping her. I mean, what writer in their right mind I won't go into that. I was going to mention that what writer in their right mind decides that when there's a problem with a lack of gravitas from the Doctor, what's needed is to have her kneel before the Master.
Oh, yeah, don't worry. I was going to bring that up, actually.
With all the, shall we say, unfortunate connotations that brings, particularly when he's saying, when she kneels, he's then saying, he doesn't actually say, call me daddy. But it's the equivalent of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think they actually resolved that quite well, because he then kneels down with her.
Well.
Which takes that away slightly.
For me, that was the absolute nadir of those two-parters.
Hmm.
A lot of people have commented about things like the way the Doctor behaved to get the Master caught by Nazis and stuff. But but for me, I don't know what Chris Chibnall was thinking to think that was a good scene to put in. It made me feel incredibly uncomfortable. I actually watched that with somebody who's recently been in a coercive, abusive relationship. And they were sat there and you could see their knuckles balled up. You know, their fists were balled up and their knuckles were going white. Because it's just such...
What, the whole relationship between the Doctor and the Master or that particular scene?
That scene. Because suddenly you've got who is supposed to be a powerful character. But because that is a woman being forced to kneel in front of a man, it subverts it in a way that's incredibly uncomfortable. For somebody who's been in a coercion and that sort of is a terrible thing in a relationship. And I just think, I don't know. I don't see, I don't get why that scene is in there. To try to show what the Doctor's prepared to do to save people's lives, possibly. But it's just... the whole connotations of it, the iconography of it, if you like, is just, it doesn't need to be, it's just wrong. They should have done it differently.
If it had just been the call me Master, what's my name thing?
Yeah.
I think, because they did that at the end of Utopia, where the Master's locked himself inside the Doctor's TARDIS. And the Doctor's saying, let me in, let me in. And the Master actually forces him to address him as Master.
Yeah.
And then he buggers off in the TARDIS anyway.
I'm asking you really properly. Just stop. Just think.
Use my name.
Master. I'm sorry.
Tough!
And I don't think this is just us, our problem here. I think this is a thousand of the years of society thinking this. Because that's two men, you don't so much think of that. It's, yes, the Master is humiliating the Doctor by forcing him to almost submit to him. When that's a male character and a female character, it's something very, very different. Now, I very much suspect that children watching this won't think that at all.
No.
They'll just think, oh, what an awful Master. But people are going to think that.
Yeah, it's because there's been thousands of years of male over female oppression. And that's what you're talking about, isn't it, Doc? When you sort of say...
And that's just in Kent.
But I think that's what you mean when you say that it's not just... You know, it's not just the way we're reading it. That's just the way...
I just felt extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When they're happening. But he's also... You've got a problem with an absence of gravitas. He feeds that. Right, she, the start of part two, she's burbling inanely to herself in the, well, she's finding stuff in that kelp forest, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Talking to herself about, oh, I don't want to be in someone's liver again.
Hi, Doctor. Oh. Hi. How are you doing? Good. Just talking to myself to prove I'm still alive. I was wondering, what would you say to the others if they were here? Don't panic. Of course, I'm usually saying it as much to myself as I am to them. Always a good reminder when you're alone. In the unknown. All hope lost. Not working here. Why not? Could be a clue. Clue to what? What was that? Interesting. Useful. Maybe. Another. Even better. What are you? Pathways? Signals? Synapses? Could be inside something. Oh, I hope it's not a liver. I hate being inside livers. People always get so offended. What are you doing in my liver again?
You think, oh, shut up.
That seems to be a character trait of her doctor, though, doesn't it? Which seems to be slightly grating. Yeah, that...
Well, also, it's unfortunate that he's chosen to say, well, let's make this doctor more vulnerable and more panicky. Mm. And it's unfortunate that it also happens to be a female, isn't it? The first female playing the role.
Yeah.
Because you can't imagine the fourth doctor panicking if he turned up in that other thing. He'd probably sit down and start playing with his yo-yo.
It just seems awkward, really. So we've got poor writing and characterisation coming from above. The one thing that could save it, and it's saved Doctor Who through the ages, is good acting. We haven't really even got that. There's been some sign of it in Spyfall. The Doctor's confrontation with Mr. Barton on the terrace is a good sign of it. Her confrontation with the Master in various scenes, like on top of the Eiffel Tower. Nothing particularly outstanding, but good by comparison with what's gone before. I've always thought that the Doctor is best when everything, even the silliness, comes out of a slightly dark and brooding character, which is a lot of probably why, because Tom's my Doctor, I probably think that. And I think we may get some scope for that, this, possibly with this series, with this whole Destruction of Gallifrey thing. Because that looks like there's going to be lots of scope for the Doctor.
Yeah.
You know, she lands on Gallifrey. She looks out of the door before we see the Citadel destroyed. And she's not saying anything. She's just looking in horror.
Yeah.
At what she's seeing. And she's not horror as in, oh my God,
no.
Waving her hands around or anything. It's just still and silent. Face isn't moving. And that's exactly the sort of acting that's needed there. Admittedly, when we've seen what's coming next week, which seems almost like a bit of like a redo of Smile. You know the one where they're in that white building under the cornfield? Oh, are they suddenly going to go from that potentiality, how she reacting to the destruction of her home planet, to a light-hearted episode? Is that going to wipe it out?
A bit like Earth Shock to Time Flight.
And it might even be that Chris Chibnall realises that there's this problem with Gravitas, and that might be the principal reason why he's destroyed Gallifrey, to give her something to... you know, suddenly have a real Eccleston-level emotional problem to deal with.
Yeah, because I have to say, she was great in the last 5 minutes of each of the episodes, wasn't she?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, genuinely, really, you can see why she got the job properly, and you just think, if that level of conviction and, like you said before, Doc, confidence in the acting and delivery could be there all the time, then I don't think we'd have anywhere near as much of a problem.
I mean, I have to say, I know where you're both coming from completely, because I do feel as though she's still kind of finding her way a little with this, but I hope that with the destruction of Gallifrey, like you said, Doc, that she becomes a bit more of a strong and sort of a steady character, because there has been that sort of babbling that we've spoken about before that is just... quite annoying, actually, and I know why it's there. It's there to make her more endearing to the Watcher, but I don't think it works, really.
But the Watcher was the Doctor all along.
And I genuinely don't want her to fail. When I said at the beginning of series 11 that my mum had said to me on the phone one day, oh, what do you think about your Doctor Who's become a woman now? And I said, oh, I'll see how it goes. And she said, she doesn't watch Doctor Who, so she's not really got that much interest in it, but she said, I hope it goes well for her, because she's been effectively put out there, not to fail, but, you know, if she does fail, it's not just going to be, oh, look, Jodie Whittaker didn't do well as Doctor Who. It's going to be, what a ridiculous idea it is ever to have a woman as Doctor Who again. I don't want her to fail. But also, the fact I don't, one of the things that I think we never do on this podcast is we don't say, I think this, therefore I demand that Chris Chibnall resigns.
Oh, God.
Or no, that Jodie's sacked. Because it's just...
Well, we're not entitled, are we?
No.
We're not entitled to an opinion like that, really. It's situations that are out of our hands, you know. And actually, you need a bit of a life if you're going to be doing that kind of thing.
Oh, dear.
Can I just link this into something I want to get on about a bit later? And that's... I do sometimes wonder, I think it was you, Doc, who mentioned this a little while ago, that reviewing the show as it's going out for the purposes of this podcast is ruining your enjoyment of the programme.
Mm.
I said that when we did, especially last year, but there were also elements of Series 10 and Series 9, which I struggled through Series 9, having to rewatch those again.
Before my time.
I've kind of struck, yeah. Yeah, before Mark and Alan. Yeah. I've got to say, I think the power of nostalgia when it comes to Doctor Who is a lot more powerful than we sometimes put it down to. Because I've got to say, if we were back in 1977 and we just watched The Brain of Morbius, we might be saying things about Tom Baker like, well, the guy's just sometimes he's a bit of a gibbering idiot. Oh, he seems completely aloof. He's not even looking his eye. John Pertwee always spoke to people completely, you know, into their eyes. He never looked off into the far distance and ignored his companions. That's completely off. And when we talk about the Russell T Davies years and Stephen Moffat years, we are always more fond of the eras that we haven't reviewed. We are, completely. I mean, you have the occasional stuff like... you know, Rosa, I think we all said very nice things about that. World Enough and Time and The Doctor Falls, Heaven Sent. That kind of stuff is obviously yes, because it is cracking television. All the rest of it, we've been maybe a little overcritical, I think. Because we've all said to a man that watched it the first time, absolutely loved it. Watched it the second time, and I thought, oh no. With stuff like The Brain of Morbius, or The Caves of Androzani, or, I don't know, The Sea Devils, let's say, for example... We've had decades of that to embed it in our consciousness.
Yeah.
This we're watching, some of us, 24 hours after we watched it before, and we're looking out for bits, whether we're doing it consciously or subconsciously, we're looking out for bits to completely pull apart. Because I have to say, I've only watched both of them once, and I almost loved it, but I haven't watched a Doctor episode twice since... Well, in that quicker turnaround, I reckon, since probably Arachnids in the UK, I think. But I watched Resolution over Christmas, and it was better than what I remembered. I didn't like The Husband's a River Song when it first came out, but gave that a couple of years, went back to it, think it's now one of the strongest Christmas specials.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, you know, and also even watching some of the Blu-rays, some of the collection stories that are coming out, reassessing stuff from season 18 and 19, which I didn't think was particularly strong, and looking back at it now and thinking, blimey, this is actually pretty good. I think we really do underestimate the power of nostalgia. And I think when it comes to the general audience as a whole, not the keyboard warriors on social media, but, you know, it's strong in the ratings. I know it was just under 5 million, but it was the second most watched thing on both days it was on.
Yeah, that's what counts.
That's not a failing show.
No.
A show that brings in millions upon millions of viewers is not a failing show. And Series 11, on the whole, didn't do that as well. Series 11 was so far removed from what we had got used to with the RTD stuff, with the Moffat stuff, with the classic era stuff, that at points it didn't feel like Doctor Who to us, which, of course, it wouldn't do because it's a brand new era and all the rest of it. But this brought it back to me, I think, dipping into that lore again made it me feel a little bit more at home watching it, which gave me more of an enjoyment, which basically took, you know, I took more enjoyment away from it.
Well, I think this ties in again to what I was saying about we don't demand sackings or resignations, because one thing we don't say, and which can get a thing that really annoys me, is I've just effectively said, I don't think Jodie performs very well. I don't think Chris Chibnall acts very well. I think Ryan Tussin and Mandip are superfluous characters. But I'm not saying, therefore, this series of Doctor Who is a disaster, because I know there's millions of people out there who are loving it. Mm. And we saw that girl on The Children in Need, I think. Her face when she saw Jodie. But when people will say, I don't think I've commented on this on social media, but I'll say on Twitter, I didn't really think much. Mainly it used to be when I was doing this on places like Outpost Gallifrey forums. I didn't like that story. And someone will come back to me and say, but the ratings were enormous.
Hmm.
And I say, yeah, but I'm not saying the nation didn't like that story. I'm just saying I didn't.
Yeah.
And this is why I think it's a good thing there's so many different Doctor Who podcasts. Because if someone thinks, oh, I'm getting sick of that guy, Doc, he's constantly bitching about Chibnall, I really like it, they can find another podcast. And it's not like with Doctor Who, if you don't like it, why do you watch it? Because we've been around 6 years. We're not embedded into people's lives and consciousness like the way Doctor Who is.
And there's plenty of alternatives, let's face it.
Yeah. I mean, nowhere near as good as us, but but I remember, Hayden's right about nostalgia and the opposite of whatever the opposite of nostalgia is, because I remember loathing The Runaway Bride.
Mm.
I quite liked Catherine Tate's comedy show, but I thought, oh God, she's this loudmouth fishwife they've got. And when they said, oh, she's coming back for series 4 as the permanent companion, on reflection, I decided from then on, I'm going to hate this series. This year that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And then 2 or 3 years later, I rewatched series 4 again. That must have been a weekend where I had nothing to do. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I can think back to the Eccleston, the first series with Christopher Eccleston back in 2005. That whole year, that series was just, I was just carried along on a wave of joy in that. I absolutely adored it, and I still think it's the best series they've done.
That, and also Good Wishes as well, because you don't want it to fail, because it's just come back and it's been in a precarious situation where if this season fails, there will never be Doctor Who again. The Parting of the Ways could have been the last ever Doctor Who story.
You could say that about every season.
No, you can't. Not really, because they sign up, you know, wasn't it Moffat signed 5 years to 2020, and now they've signed more. But the stakes were higher, wasn't it, with that?
Let's say the two-parter we're reviewing tonight had been The Impossible Plans and the Satan Pit, which I think is one of the best stories in David Tennant's era.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
I could well have been missing all the great things, because I might have been spent this whole night whining about the, oh God, they love it, they just love themselves so much, don't they? This sort of narcissistic relationship between them. And I don't get lost in that. But let's cheer up. Let's talk about something that we really like, which is Sacha Dhawan's Master.
Mm.
The only slight weakness I've got in it is I think all of us were astonished. We didn't see it coming. But it's not like having seen him reveal who he was, we're then thinking, it's not like Fight Club or Sixth Sense, where you're then thinking, oh, of course. The only person who's been speaking to Bruce Willis through this whole film has been the little kid. There's not really been anything in the whole build-up to that you would think, apart from that one or two little things like, oh, he's got those really good defences in his hut in Australia, hasn't he? Would we really have lost anything in the build-up to the reveal if Graham had turned round on that plane and he turned out to be the Master? You wouldn't have thought, oh, well, that doesn't work. That would have worked just as well. Even better, actually, because if you think, Graham's a West Ham fan. So it should have been obvious to us that he was irredeemably evil at heart.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. Absolutely.
Hang on, let me just place my microphone next to Mark's skull.
I'm forever blowing bubbles.
And I was slightly scared at the end of part one, where he says, yeah, and I'm the master. And he was doing a sort of twirly, grinning panto thing. I said, oh, I hope he's not going to be doing John Sim. But he didn't. He's much more serious. And occasionally there's this thing where you'll suddenly yell with anger, which you think, oh, please don't do that, because you lose control of your acting when you do that. But otherwise, I think he's been a revelation. Mm. And it's not just his acting. Can you guess what it is I love most about Sacha Dhawan's portrayal of the Master?
The costume?
No. He's the exception to most of the other actors in that he's not doing that exaggerated sloppiness of speech patterns.
Oh, yeah.
Here we've got the Doctor, a wise and authoritative genius who's as old as the universe, though you'd never guess it from Jodie's portrayal. She might well speak with a Yorkshire accent, as Christopher Eccleston would speak with a Manchester Salford accent. But I can't believe that she'd speak with a sloppy Yorkshire accent. I mean, just back in 2005, I complained, it must have been pre-podcast, it would have been on the forums probably, at the end of the cold open, end of the world, something happens, and the Doctor says,
that's not supposed to happen.
I thought, no, you could use northern vowels and consonants, but I can't believe in a million years that the Doctor would drop an H like that. And I find it extraordinarily irritating. It's not entirely unlikely that this is because I'm the sort of person, when I was being brought up, if I dropped an H, or if I said, you was doing this, my mum would immediately correct me. You were doing this, Doc, she said. Well, mind you, I was a kid then, so she would have said, you were doing this, medical student.
Well, you say about dropping H's. I once dropped an E and it got me into all kinds of trouble.
I find it irritating enough when Yaz does it. Fortunately, Ryan doesn't give it the full welly, though I think that Yaz is actually exaggerating it for effect. But it's something unbelievable the Doctor would do it. And it detracts from her gravitas.
Hmm.
It doesn't mean she's a less virtuous person or you like her less. It's just that you can't believe. I mean, she's effectively an alien speaking a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
If I was speaking French, I wouldn't...
It would make conversation difficult for me and Mark.
And they exaggerate this sloppy speech patterns to the point where it actually detracts from the flow of dialogue. If you're doing a long sentence, I'm not claiming that I don't do this, but if you're doing a long sentence, dropping the H from the start of the word or the G from the end, are you having a good time? Does actually speed along the flow of the sentence. But doing what the Doctor and Yaz are doing, which is actually inserting a glottal stop, actively slows down the sentence because you're replacing the consonants you've dropped with something else. So, for instance, they put a glottal stop in late.
Hi, fam. Where are you? It's in an hour. You're late. Very late.
Putting a glottal stop into the word late is harder than not doing so. Oh, I'm late. That doesn't flow any more quickly than late. There's the point where, I think it's Yaz says, you nearly managed it.
MI6 is trying to kill us.
No!
Well, you nearly managed it.
So, even if he wasn't a fine actor, putting on a great performance, I would adore the new Master, if only for his beautiful diction. And
pardon?
I see him as defending northern speech from the barbarian actors who seem to think that sounding consonants is posh. So you can sound out consonants with a northern accent. Of course, Sacha, in a way, has had a privileged upbringing denied to Jodie and Mandip, in that he was born and raised west of the Pennines. Maybe that's where we're being unfair to them. And what about his glorious line?
And a complete set of 14 times in mint condition.
I haven't heard that many crisply enunciated dentals in Doctor Who for years. Could this mark, and forget what's happening to going to happen to Gallifrey in this story arc, could the story arc, this series, be the Doctor, the Master, bringing about the end of the glottal stop? Go Sacha, I say, if that's the case. But no, I think he's absolutely, they've picked someone. The only possible slight disappointment is you think, oh, we can never now play the Doctor. Then you could say that about anyone, couldn't you?
Yes, I did think that, actually.
It's like saying, wouldn't it have been great if she or he had become a companion?
Yeah.
you can't always say that, otherwise the TARDIS would be packed.
What did you think of their exchange when he's the hologram talking to her? Because I thought that was a high point of the second part. That exchange where she's pretty much silent but reacting only through...
If you're seeing this, you've been to Gallifrey. When I said someone did that, obviously I meant I did. I had to make them pay for what I discovered. They lied to us. The founding fathers of Gallifrey. Everything we were told was a lie. We're not who we think. You or I. Whole existence of our species built on the lie of the timeless child. Do you see it? It's buried deep in all our memories. In our identity. You more, but why would I make it easy for you? It wasn't for me.
I think the way emotion flashes across Sasha's face in various scenes, and you just see flickers of it sometimes, and he really is a superb actor, and Jodie definitely upped her game when she was acting opposite him.
And yes.
You're right, yeah. that scene was great, and as mentioned before, the scene at the top of the Eiffel Tower as well. It's good because, you know, it's nice to get a doctor and master combination where they spark off each other and you can see that they bring the best out in each other, and I do think they've got that as long as they're getting the...
Yeah.
And which gives me hope for Jodie.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember what we were saying about the Key to Time series? The worst two stories, well, in my opinion, Crawl and Armageddon, are the only two stories in which Tom hasn't got a top character actor to go toe-to-toe with. You know, he's got Ian Cuthbertson, he's got Peter Jeffrey, he's got Beatrice Lehmann, he's got... who's the captain? Brian Purchase, who, whether he's a great actor or not, but at least he shouts really loud. I think it could be the making of Jodie. Certainly, it might take away from sights of her... I don't think anyone has looked quite so gormless as the sight of the Doctor sprinting after the plane with the Sonic held at arm's length.
Yeah, I know. I think there's this thing that, her looking gormless is endearing.
Yeah.
And I think it is to some people. Some people love that. You see it online, people doing GIFs and memes, and like, oh, she's so adorable when she's like this because she's so goofy. Mm. Perhaps it's just because of our age, but it's not what we're looking for in a Doctor, is it?
It's not endearing, but it's something which David Tennant and Matt Smith were very good at, or very popular doing that. So I think she's sort of taken that. And actually, Eccleston did a bit of it as well. So it's, you know, it's the way that they sort of fed off each other, I guess.
But just even Fry got killed, I thought. What do we think of Lenny Henry?
Having seen him in Broadchurch and play an edgy, slightly iffy character in that as well, I was convinced by him.
Yeah.
I think if you'd gone into it cold thinking of Lenny Henry the comedian, I don't think you'd have got the same feeling from it.
He's a good actor, I think, so yeah, I thought he did fine.
But considering that, and considering his speech to that sort of Question Time audience...
Oh, that was really weird. That whole scene was really odd, wasn't it? Where he's talking to that audience and they just sit there. I presume that's something at Chibnall's insistence, that all these people are just gormless and acting like sheep to sort of overplay his point a bit. But it just looks totally unnatural and unreal, that scene. I just thought, you know, why isn't anyone saying anything? And that speech at the end about the tech companies and thank you for all the data you've shared and every time you've done this and every time you've done that, I thought it was far too on the nose. I thought Lenny Henry delivered it brilliantly, but I thought, again, I thought it was just far too on the nose, kind of stating the obvious, it seemed to me.
Yeah. Anyone out of the UK doesn't know what Question Time is. It's, I think it's the Australian sort of equivalent is called Q&A, I think. It's where a panel of public figures answer questions from an audience who, I think on Question Time, the proud boast is that the audience is made up of from a scientifically selected cross-section of the nation's gullible morons. He's effectively telling them, I'm going to kill you in 3 minutes, and they say nothing. Mm. But also, one thing that's worse than that, what, is he killing his mother? Where is his intellectual or emotional motivation in this?
Oh, well, it's a woman who never said well done. He's obviously felt neglected during his childhood and is deranged enough to want to take revenge in a way that he would take the life of his own mother.
But it doesn't come across as it being in the slightest bit deranged. Maybe slightly. I thought killing his mother was on a par with Anakin turning to the dark side because he was in a bad mood one day.
I suppose so.
What do we think of Ada Lovelace and Noreen Ayat Khan?
Well, like I said earlier, I was pleased by their inclusion because it meant I got to learn what they did, you know, and
yes,
their placing in history. So I was happy with them. Yeah, I thought they were well realised as well.
Very Carver name with pride, wasn't it? Although I did think, I thought that was strange about what they did with Charles Babbage. Do you remember in Twice Upon a Time, this bizarre conversation that the First Doctor and Mark Gatiss are having?
Quite beautiful, really, isn't she?
Yeah, if you like, ladies made of glass.
Well, aren't all ladies made of glass? In a way.
Very good, sir, very good.
They start giggling to each other. Mm. And you think, what on earth are they talking about? And then at one point, Charles Babbage is looking at the little dancing figure in the glass block and says,
this is the Silver Lady. A revolutionary piece of engineering. But, like all great ladies, she is as much for decoration as for purpose.
And I thought that was similar to that. And I was thinking, are they trying to make him look a bit of a dick in order to make Ada look smarter, if only by comparison? You know, rather than give her any lines that make her look like a genius. Charles Babbage was a genius. Ada Lovelace was a genius. It doesn't make her appear any more of a genius to make Charles Babbage a bit of a prick.
Yeah.
I thought it was slightly annoying. I like the way the Ryan Graham relationship is going now.
Hmm.
You know, they ditched all that slightly irritating friction from last year.
That's one thing I like about this TARDIS team, is the fact that everyone seems to get on and we haven't got these weird tensions. Yes. Yeah. And we haven't got people, we haven't got those weird things with the Doctor and Clara. I'm talking about Peter Capaldi's Doctor and Clara falling out horribly. And it's nice, I like that atmosphere, to be honest. I wish you wouldn't call them fam, but I don't mind considering them her family, but... But yes, it's nice to have a happy TARDIS of people who appreciate and enjoy each other's company.
Yeah.
Actually. And I think it's absolutely quite nice, especially in these dark times. Can I just say quickly as well, that was one thing, one line I liked. Well, in fact, there's a couple of lines I like, but regards to dark times. Darkness never sustains, I thought was a nice positive line to throw into a family TV show with the world going as it is. In my opinion.
Who said that?
The Doctor says it to Ada Lovelace.
Right.
When she's looking out the window at Paris. And the Doctor says, yes, these are dark times. But she says it won't sustain. Darkness never sustains. And I just thought that was a nice positive message.
This is the future. A world on fire.
These are the dark times. But they don't sustain. Darkness never sustains, even though sometimes it feels like it might.
While I'm on the line of lines, can I also mention a couple of other things that I liked?
Go for it.
You don't need to ask permission, Mark. You know that eventually, if you keep asking this, I will just say no, you can't.
There was the line from the Doctor to the Master as they made contact, and she said,
oh, yeah.
After he'd been shrinking somebody with his tissue compression Eliminator, and then they do the contact thing, and she goes, "You're not the only one who can do classic." And I thought that was a nice line.
Yeah.
And on the rewatch, the funniest line, which you don't notice on the first viewing, so it's slightly wasted on people who are only watching it for the first time and don't know the history of the Master. But there's a bit when they're walking into Barton's villa and O says, "Is this a good time to mention that I've never really done undercover work before?" And looking back on it, knowing he's the Master, that's such easily the biggest whopper he's ever told. And for me, the biggest laugh I had during my rewatch.
Is this about time to mention I've never really done undercover work?
A few little extras. Paris was never bombed nightly. Certainly not in 1943, and certainly not the centre of Paris.
It was bombed, though.
Only the outskirts in the... and it was very rarely bombed. On the Eiffel Tower, Paris is ablaze all around them. Our loved one C is showing them the boxes of spy equipment, and Graham reaches to fiddle with one and he just slaps it away.
Yeah.
And, of course, we noticed the tribute to Terence Dick.
Yes, was lovely, yes. The masterful.
The masterful Terence Dick, yes. And so, I've ended this happier than I thought I would. But enunciation of consonants will do that. In fact, I might have that carved on the lintel of the museum outside, that line. A complete set of 14 times in mint condition. And I think I'll have every T in it. I'll have it outlined in gold leaf. So...
Are we giving marks out of 10 yet?
Oh, yes. Hayden?
I'm going 8.5 out of 10.
Are you doing both episodes together?
Well, if not, I'd say...
Well, what are we doing? What's the...
Yes, let's do them separately.
All right, I'll go for 9 for the first one, and I'll go for 8 for the second.
I think that's a good split of your general score. Not that I would score it so high myself, but I would say that I felt the first part for me was a point ahead of the second part.
Hmm.
And I'm almost tempted to knock off another half, actually, just for that awful... For that scene that annoyed me so much, the kneeling scene, I would go... Now, do you know what? Actually, I won't go that far. I'll go for 8 and 7.
Right, well, I think I will go for 6.5 and 7.5. And the 6.5 is raised possibly a point, or maybe just over half a point, by the good pace that the different sort of plot and story gives to the... gives to the episode, and in the second case it's raised by probably a full point by Sacha Dhawan's superb diction. Okie dokie. So if we've nothing more to say, oh, here come the sons of Skaro. What do you two want?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray, there are enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Bye all.
Bye everyone.
Bye. Till next time.
I have always thought that's torn it. What are you doing, Stig? He's getting out of here. Well, I'm going to get out of here too.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.